Dr. Michelle, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Jess.
Now, there's an old term called cabin fever that's surfacing a lot again at the moment. What is cabin fever, though?
Actually a colloquial term to indicate that one might be kind of feeling quite confined within one space. And of course, as you know, at the moment, you know, we're asked to self-isolate or be in our house as much as we can, other than going out for essential services. And those restrictions are expected to probably increase as time goes by. So this idea that one might be experiencing more and more cabin fever might arise. So there's not really a proper measurement of cabin fever per se, but it's this idea of us really adjusting to kind of feeling confined and refrained. And really, I think it comes with this idea as well, like you don't feel in control at the moment. And that's actually quite, I guess, a quite normal and strange circumstances.
Absolutely. What is the predicted toll that this prolonged period of self-isolation will have on mental health and physical health?
Look, you know, the last time we had a pandemic was the Spanish influenza. So I think we actually don't know as researchers what this long-term or prolonged self-isolation entails. What we do expect, though, is that, you know, mental health kind of might take a little bit of a beating at this stage, because it is a period of adjustment, and it's adjustment to the way we interact, to the way we work, to the way we socialize. You know, as you mentioned earlier, you know, humans are social, so we are very, very much used to functioning in groups and used to these interactions. We expect that there might be high levels of depression, high levels of social anxiety, or high levels of stress, especially for young people or many people who might have lost their jobs. You know, it's a period where it's a very difficult circumstance where everyone's really financially and economically and socially stressed out.
Are there any demographics that are particularly vulnerable to this kind of restlessness of anxiety and depression during these times?
But we do know that people who are socially vulnerable are probably more at risk, given that we are having these added pressures of social isolation or self-isolation, can I just say. So younger people, for example, might feel this need to socialize but unable to, if their friendship networks aren't cemented or they don't feel confident about those relationships. They might feel more socially anxious at this point, and added with the stresses of maybe keeping up at school, or how do they keep up at school, or whether their performance will be affected, whether they will lose their job. And then, of course, you know, you have the people who are most socially vulnerable, who we are trying to protect, which is the people who are older. And for many people, they already feel lonely and they're really already socially isolated. So any kind of added constraints may seem a lot for them, because it's really taking away the level of control that they have at the moment.
I've heard some conversations around maybe changing the language that we're using at this time, instead of saying social distancing, saying physical distancing, stuff like that, to try and re-approach how we are looking at this kind of next period of time in our lives. How do we best look out for our friends and our neighbours without kind of violating social distancing or quarantine procedures?
Yeah. Look, I think, you know, if you have the technology, you know, I think we have to maximize it. You know, and I say really going further than what we are usually doing. And most young people, for example, would text, you know, and I would say it's not constrained to young people, but a lot of people would text and email. If it's something that is worthwhile kind of picking up the phone and actually using that phone functionality or actually videoing people, like, actually, you know, that's basic. So we have to go back to basics. We have to be flexible. We have to use the full range.
Back to basics.
For example, exactly. So, for example, I would actually say to my friends, I would text them and say, I'm going to give you a call, you know, just to prepare them. Or I'm going to do a video call, group chat or something like that, to actually try to kind of, you know, use the full functionality so that we can really take in all the interactions, actually look at people's faces, not just listen to their voices. You know, kind of getting that full or maximized, the full effects of having a social interaction. You know, that's really important. And if you don't have that capability, or you're not, you know, you're not maybe so confident using tech, you know, your neighbors are, you know, talking through the fence, you know, little things like that, or really going old fashioned, writing letters.
Oh, yes. Let's
things
go
that we
way
used
back.
To do.
Yeah.
Exactly. Let's go way back. You know, these things are possible. You know, it's really important that we take care of our social health. And if, as you mentioned, social distance or physical distance doesn't mean that we have to stop connecting. It actually means that we have to do more, and it means that we can maximize the efforts when we do interact with people, actually make that mean something, make that positive, make that, you know, we are all in this together. It's a shared experience.
Absolutely.
Support each other and be kind. And there are ways that we can do that without really jeopardizing our physical health.
Absolutely. Dr. Lim, unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks, Jess, for having me.